Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, serving the MSU and Oakland University communities with personal and business financial services, including checking and savings plans, loans, mortgages, and online transactions, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.
Coasting here to start the week after a nice weekend in mid-Michigan, its current state on WKAR. The weekend included a homestand triumph for the Detroit Tigers, 8-0 at home, with a walk-off victory to seal it off last night in extra innings. I was at the game on Saturday night, and even from way, way out in left field, with the sun right between the eyes, even there, Max Scherzer was so much fun to watch. Love that off-speed stuff he throws that was so effective on Saturday night. Looking ahead here to the coming week, a reminder that Current State broadcasts live this Friday evening from the East Lansing Folk Festival. We will be looking for you. Voters in Lansing will go to the polls tomorrow for a primary election that will narrow the field of candidates for mayor and for the city council. Mayor Virge Bernero is running for another term, and he has four challengers. The top two vote-getters will advance to November's general election. And joining us here today to talk about the mayor's race in Lansing and the 4th Ward District, the city council races as well, reporters Lindsay Van Holly of the Lansing State Journal. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, good morning.
And Andy Belaskovitz, the Lansing City Pulse. Good to see you, Andy.
Hi, Mark. Good to see you.
Before we get into the primary, Lindsay, LSJ executive editor Mickey Hurton spent his last day at the paper on Friday. What did you consider Mickey's strengths as an executive editor during your tenure there?
He has such a big picture vision. You know, he's a very passionate and committed journalist, and you know, has a really strong sense of what makes great enterprise and great watchdog stories, and really encouraged us all to go after those as best we could. So we're going to miss him dearly.
Yeah. Let's move on to tomorrow's primary and the vote on Lansing mayor that features the incumbent Virge Bernero and four challengers. Mayor Bernero's appeared on Current State here a couple of times in 2013. Back in January, he was here to preview his State of the City address. At the time, he described the dynamic between his administration and the council as being as healthy as ever.
You know, New Year's came, and there was sort of a New Year's resolution by the council, the now council president, Carol Wood, that she wanted to turn the page and build a more trusting relationship. And so part of it is I met with her. I mean, we really hadn't talked much outside of council meetings. So she said she'd like to meet with me and you know, have sort of a professional relationship, which would be a new thing. And so we've done that, and so far, so good.
You think she would agree with that? You're off to a good start?
I hope so.
Andy, how has the dynamic between the mayor and the city council played out since then, in your view?
I don't think that honeymoon lasted very long. And I think it was right around the first of the year. I think I was on this show talking about some internal investigations into a council member's laptop computer. And I think, if I remember correctly, you know, talking to Virge about that same time and saying, you know, what is going on here? This thing, the way Carol runs the city council, you know, isn't what I had envisioned. And ever since then, it seems like it hasn't been as, you know, merry as he kind of portrayed it at the beginning of the year.
Is that an issue for the voters tomorrow? The whole mayor council vibe?
I think it's been an issue for voters for the past several years. And it's largely a perception thing. You know, when you hear council members talk about it, they say, you know, it's largely this perception that people have of us up here. We're really trying to work this out amongst ourselves, but it just time and again, it just doesn't seem to work out that way.
Lindsay, what do you make of the mayor council vibe, and is that going to be an issue for voters tomorrow, do you think?
Well, in doing some of my reporting initially, talking to candidates, you know, a lot of them, especially the ones who aren't incumbents, had sort of the view that, you know, I'm going to come in as sort of an independent thinker. I'm going to be a fresh a fresh voice on the dais. So, you know, they're sort of coming in saying that I'm not aligned with any particular side. And so it'll be interesting to see sort of how voters, you know, perceive that perception today.
By the time the mayor was back on Current State in May, he was describing the council as out to lunch on economic development matters. He described himself as aggressively pro-business while saying that the council has a passive-aggressive approach.
For example, they want to raid the Economic Development Fund right now. They propose in their budget, I think it's like $1 million they're trying to take out of economic development when it's unnecessary and it's counterproductive. And you're really eating your young when you do that. One of the reasons that we're doing well, we talked about manufacturing, but we're doing well in bioscience, we're doing well in insurance. You know, we've got growth across the board in Lansing in tough times because we never stopped investing. We never stopped working. Now, they want to hobble our EDC and take money away. I'm not going to allow that. That's insanity.
This takes us back to his opponents on the council being unable to muster the votes to veto any part of his budget or anything else for that matter. They just don't have the votes right now, including the streetlights and fire hydrants. How important is this ability, is this need to maintain the veto-proof majority here?
Absolutely, Mark. And, you know, we've seen with the field of candidates this year in the mayor's race that really it's kind of a foregone conclusion that Verge is going to get another term. And I think his opponents recognized that a long time ago. And so the strategy has been, well, we'll go after his power via the council by getting 6 votes that'll hold up to his veto. And especially in the 4th Ward, this is playing out between Chongyin and Kinfora, who's got a lot of built-in labor support. And that's also kind of where this economic development issue spills over, is the building trades and organizations who are going to get to work on some of these projects and how their politics fit into this. And Verge and the building trades haven't had a very good relationship over the past 2-3 years now.
With regard to the 4th Ward in particular, Lindsey Van Hollie, what are you going to be looking at? Which vote counts are you going to be looking at most closely tomorrow night?
Well, obviously, anytime there's an incumbent running, that's one to watch. I think you know, Jessica has a strong platform that she has been that she's been running on, and I think she's got some interesting challengers in that ward.
Which one or two do you find most interesting?
Well, I think, you know, as Andy mentioned, I think Chongana has the, you know, the name recognition at this point, too, where she's been out, you know, she's been out there a lot, and really in trying to promote her views as well. So I think it's going to be, it's the closest of the council races that I've seen so far.
Yeah. Anything to say about Bert Carrier Jr. or Larry Hutchinson? Carrier's an attorney. Larry Hutchinson's a 40-year-old Lansing stay-at-home dad. Andy?
Yeah, well, from what I know about Bert, we've talked a few times. He's an attorney, lives downtown. He's very much into this sort of free market approach to economic development. I think he did say he wants to try and get rid of the income tax in the city. I'm not sure how that would play out if he was elected. But he's very pro downtown development. Larry Hutchinson, I haven't had much of a chance to speak with him, so I can't comment too much on his candidacy.
And just to back up a little bit, Jessica Yorko is considered a member of the mayor's voting bloc on the city council. Are you saying that Bert Carrier would also be considered a member of that bloc?
No, I'm not saying that, and I'm sure that Bert would dispute that as well. I think he,
really?
as Lindsey mentioned, there's candidates who are pitching themselves as not falling into one of these camps, and I think he has you know, publicly stated that he's disagreed with the mayor on certain issues, but that they're really lockstep when it comes to getting downtown development.
What does Chongyana Kinfora say with regard to this voting block thing, where she would fall?
You know, she has mentioned that, you know, she would work well with council, she'd work well with the mayor. She doesn't see herself aligned with any one particular side, and would come in with sort of that independent, fresh view.
You reported last week, Lindsey, on fundraising. The mayor's raised $75,000 more than any of his opponents, and only First Ward Council member Harold Lehman Jr. had any fundraising to report. Former council member Harold Lehman, and that was less than $1,000. Money is obviously a blowout for the mayor here. Is there anything else in play here that's worth watching? I mean, Lehman did spend some time on the city council.
I think just the fact that you know, the incumbent mayor has been in his position for a long time. He has a lot of backing, a lot of support from different groups, you know, individuals to organizations and some of the unions as well. So it certainly makes sense that he's going to have a lot of campaign funding. Mm-hmm. To begin with,
does Lehman's tenure on the city council mean he's the likely other guy on the ballot in November, Andy?
You could probably say that. You could probably say that Harold has the best name recognition out of any of the other candidates besides
sure.
Verge running for mayor. So yeah.
Let's talk about the other two here. We asked the four other candidates to respond to some issues, and we heard back from two of them, Harold Lehman and Gene Gutierrez Rodriguez. Lehman is the former city councilman. Harold commented, ensuring the growth of the tax base, funding long-term liabilities, including retirement pensions and health benefits for city employees, and keeping the middle class from moving out of the city. This is just another visit to Lansing's long-term fiscal problems. Does he have the horses? What kind of tenure did he have on city council?
Well, he spent some time as council president, and I know there was a time, this was before I was covering the council,
okay.
But I know he and Brian Jeffries had sort of an issue, not unlike we saw this year when it came to who was going to be the next council president. There was some sort of deal worked out, and then they went back on it. Harold led the council there. He lost re-election in the first ward by something like 17 votes by Eric Hewitt in the first ward. I think that kind of surprised him. He's always sort of run on for other offices since then with this sort of I have council experience, you know, over a decade
yeah.
on council. So
we got an interesting comment from mayoral candidate Gene Gutierrez Rodriguez. He told us, my long-term goal for Lansing is for it to become an energy and food independent community on the path to enlightenment that attracts intellectuals and innovators in all fields while being the leader in human rights. Have either of you spent much time with Gene?
I haven't spent time with him personally. I've talked with him over the phone a couple times about specific issues. Very
idealistic
man. The rest of these candidates, you know, are just getting into politics, it sounds like,
yeah.
for kind of the first time. So it's not totally unexpected, but it's, you know, it is what it is.
Current State also reached out to the two other candidates running for Lansing mayor, John Boyce and Donald Kreps. We received no response. Can you tell us anything about Boyce or Kreps?
I actually did not get a chance to talk to Donald Kreps, but I did talk with John Boyce a bit. He mentioned that, you know, he is concerned about, you know, financially, that, you know, taxes are getting too high and that base is becoming unsustainable for people living in the city. So,
with the likelihood of the mayor's reelection, what might that do to the city council races again, Andy?
Well, it's going to put a lot of attention on not just the fourth ward race, but also one of the at-large seats that are up. Incumbents Kathy Dunbar and Brian Jeffries are both up for reelection.
Yes.
There's candidates Judy Brown Clark and Ted O'Dell who are challengers who, you know, at this point, I think it could get a little interesting after the primary to see how that works out. But you got to remember, Brian and Kathy both have a lot of built-in support in this city. They've served on council several terms now, so they're coming into it with that. But the fourth ward, as we mentioned earlier, I think is going to receive a lot of attention.
Lindsay, for our listeners who didn't catch it, tell them about your story in yesterday's State Journal about the Keep GM film.
Sure. It actually had come to our attention that, you know, there was a group working early on a documentary trying to sort of revisit that time in the late 1990s when it appeared that General Motors might leave the city. Its plants were getting older and they were running inefficiently. So the idea came up, actually. It was former Mayor David Hollister and a couple of others really from that time who were sort of instrumental in that Blue Ribbon Committee that he formed, decided first to sort of start to capture some of these oral histories, before people begin to pass on. And it turned into, you know, there's really a narrative here, a theme. So they're trying to sort of weave some of those stories together, trying to find some archival, you know, B-roll footage, if you will, to sort of weave in to make really a 90-minute feature feature film.
And so. Terry at Message Makers in Old Town is kind of spearheading the production of the thing, correct?
They're working, to sort of stream some of this together. Yeah, they're working right now on a fundraising campaign. They need about half of a $200,000 goal, hopefully by the end of the year, in order to complete that project.
To make it a film, and they want to pitch it to public PBS stations and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. What are you working on right now?
Well, just gearing up for the election. It's going to be a big day tomorrow.
Yeah. Andy, what about you?
Yeah, we're watching the election. We're sort of got an eye on what's going on in terms of filling an open Ingham County Commission seat. That I think there's a deadline on Wednesday for that for candidates. Deb DeLeon is leaving the commission, so they're going to appoint a new member.
That's it. Okay, very good. Great to have both of you on board. Lindsay Van Holly is with the Lansing State Journal. Andy Belaskovitz represents the Lansing City Pulse. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Late last week, MSU's Facility for Rare Isotope Beams received several critical approvals from the U.S. Department of Energy. The nuclear science facility would potentially bring jobs to the area and make MSU even more attractive to talented researchers. Here to talk about this latest development is Thomas Glassmacher. He's the FRIB project manager, and he joins us now in the studios. Nice to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you.
Before we get into last week's specific announcement, give us non-physicists another quick refresher on what the FRIB project is. And how it differs from the MSU cyclotron.
All right. Well, the cyclotron's been here since 1965, really, when we made the first proton beam. The FRIB will be the next generation of accelerator. It's about 1,000 times more powerful than the existing cyclotrons, and it's going to make rare isotope beams, those that used to be found on Earth but are no longer here. They're unstable and decay in a split second. We make them available to researchers from all over the world, and they do basic research.
And what gets accelerated in this process?
So what's getting accelerated is any element between hydrogen and uranium. The researchers write proposals, and they get evaluated by scientific peers on their scientific merit. And then as a user facility, we provide the beams that are interesting to them, xenon, gold, lead.
And where on the atomic table, the atomic chart, does hydrogen and uranium fall?
Well, hydrogen is the lightest.
Is number one,
is number
right?
one.
Yeah.
And uranium is the heaviest one that's stable and that we can accelerate.
Okay, where on the chart is that?
It's 92.
Now, is that, okay, so anywhere for any of those 92 elements
yes,
are subject to acceleration?
Well, and you tell us what you want and we'll accelerate it for you.
Sounds user-friendly.
That's our goal. We have customers we need to make happy.
And then again, in general terms, what do you learn when these particles get accelerated?
Right. So the scientific motivation is different for different users we have. Some of them want to understand what holds atomic nuclei together. We're made of atomic nuclei, but we don't have a good understanding of the force yet that holds them together. Other folks want to understand how the elements were made. They continue to be made in stars, but again, we need nuclear physics input to have models that have predictive power to see how elements were made. And lastly, we want to enable the benefit of rare isotopes for society. So we make, if you want, designer isotopes for folks who then use them in other applications, medical, material science, and so on.
Fascinating. So last week's announcement from the U.S. Department of Energy it sounds like the bond got tighter, or the process got accelerated, as long as we're talking of acceleration.
That's
here.
So last week's announcement was the approval of what they call Critical Decision 2. When you build one-of-a-kind science facilities, there's not a blueprint you can take and you duplicate one because it's one-of-a-kind and hasn't been built before. So the way they deliver these projects, the Department of Energy has certain gates we have to pass through. We first have to do a conceptual design that's called Critical Decision 1 when that's approved, and that was approved in 2010. So now we have our baseline approved, where we now enter into a fixed schedule, a fixed cost, and a fixed scope. That's in 2013, and now with this approval, we do have a schedule. We will deliver FRIP in June of 2022, but internally we're managing to an earlier completion in December of 2020.
Hmm. And what will make the difference between 2020 and 2022?
Well, 2020 is our goal, and of course FRIP funding is subject to annual appropriation. There can be technical issues, so we have 18 months of schedule float at the end that with large certainty we will be done by 2022, but we want to, of course, deliver those beams as soon as possible to our users. So our internal goal is to work as fast and as diligently as we can to be done by the end of 2020.
Now, do the Department of Energy folks like hearing that kind of thing? Do they like hearing that, hey, we'll definitely have it done by 2022, but you know what? We can do even better than that.
They like that, and that's part of the approach. I mean, you need to have a stretch goal, so maybe it'll be early 2021, but we're managing towards 2020.
So the schedule, the cost as well. Tell us about that.
So the cost, it's just like the cost is $730 million total project cost, of which the community here shares $94.5 million. In these one-of-a-kind project, the cost gets developed, and at this point, when DOE approves cost, scope, and schedule, they have trust and certainty that we will be able to deliver that scope on that schedule for that cost.
$730 million, and that breaks down between basically federal money and university money?
Federal money and community money, university and state, $94.5 million, and the remainder is federal.
And how much more fundraising remains to be done?
There isn't really any fundraising that needs to be done.
That's probably not the best choice of words. But
Well, okay, so the Congress appropriates federal money every year, but you can't really fundraise from them. So for the next fiscal year that starts in October, the President requested $55 million, the House and the Senate marked up $55 million. So if there's an appropriation, we're looking forward to that, which allows us to go through FY14, and then for FY15, the same thing starts again. So every year there'll be a congressional appropriation of the federal funds.
Does the atmosphere over budgets in Washington, is that a big concern for you and for people who want to see the FRIB happen?
It's a
contentious atmosphere.
It's a contentious atmosphere, but it's a constraint we live in, and we have bicameral support in the House and in the Senate. We have bipartisan support from the Republicans and from the Democrats, and it's really a Michigan issue, and we have state support and MSU support, so it's a constraint, the atmosphere, but we're doing okay.
Very good. Thomas Glassmacher is the project manager for the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams here at Michigan State University. Pleasure to have you in. We'll have you back.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Coming up on Current State, the 36th annual Michigan Wine Competition happens tomorrow here in East Lansing. Learn more, that is on the way. Stay close. Current State on WKAR. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Tomorrow, the 36th annual Michigan Wine Competition will take place at the Kellogg Center here in East Lansing, where some of Michigan's top wineries will present their most delectable creations to a panel of some of the foremost wine experts from across the state and the nation. The prize, recognition, validation, and coveted accolades like the gold medal and the best of class awards. Here to talk about the event as well as our state's ever-growing wine industry, Carol Bush, promotion specialist for the Michigan Grape and Wine Council. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
And Lee Lutz, winemaker at Black Star Farms in Traverse City, who's on the phone. Hi, Lee.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Carol.
Carol, to start, give us the basics on the wine competition. What happens tomorrow exactly?
What happens tomorrow? All these judges, 25 judges, come in from around the country. Half of them are from in-state, half of them from other states. Winemakers, wine writers, other experts, people who run their own competitions in other international competitions, they come in. We arrange, this year we have 450 wines, and we arrange all of those into what we call flights. They are organized in flights that are similar types of wines. So all of the dry Rieslings are together, all of the Cabernet Francs are together, things like that to present to the judges throughout the day in a way that makes sense to them. There are panels of four judges, so six panels of four judges. Each panel will evaluate about 80 wines throughout the day.
I guess when you first started organizing this event 13 years ago, there were only about 25 wineries in the state?
Correct.
There are now about 100. Lee, from your point of view, what has fueled this rise in recent years?
Well, Mark, I think there are a number of things that have fueled it. Certainly, the Grape and Wine Industry Council and the work that it's done, just from the standpoint of helping us get the word out that we're a quality wine-producing state, and that we've got some interesting and dynamic wines here to offer and to show to the consumer. Certainly, the campaigns like Pure Michigan that have helped to support the tourism industry up here and throughout the state, bringing people from adjoining states and from outside the region to come in and see what it is we're doing. The growth of the locavore movement and people in general within the state and from around the state having an interest in all things local. Good local food, good local wines, those things obviously going together. And then the growth of that with things like creameries and new breweries. And it just, you know, it all feeds into the same pool and the same interest, and that's certainly been a part of it. I think the quality of the wines themselves have increased substantially over the years, just from the standpoint of vineyards getting older, some of us as winemakers having stayed in the state for quite some time and becoming that much more familiar with the fruit that we're working with and just making better and better wines.
Has the science of growing grapes improved over the years, Lee?
It has. Michigan State has played a significant role with us in that, and certainly the issues that go into the production of quality fruit first, and then the production of quality wines and the dynamics in the production of quality wines certainly has played a role, and Michigan State's been a big part of that as well over the years.
Carol, for climactic reasons, Michigan's long been known for our white wines over our reds. Why is that, and could more red wine grapes be grown in the future?
Yes, more red wine. Well, actually, a lot of red wine grapes are being grown right now. They need a longer growing season. They need more heat throughout the season, and especially upper Michigan, in some years, doesn't get just quite enough to be able to have really great ripe red grapes to make wonderful, because it starts with the grapes, to make wonderful wines. In southern Michigan, it's more often that they can get a nice long growing season for the reds, and so you'll find a lot of reds, unusual reds, being grown in southern Michigan that people might not be familiar with. For example, there are some there's some hybrids called Chamberson and Chancellor, for instance. People aren't familiar with those names, but they're often blended into other wines to add flavor. They are more recently, in the last 5 years or so, wineries are creating them, or they're producing them as varietals, as, and they're labeling them as a Chancellor or as a Chamberson. And as people become more aware of these varieties, I think that they'll be a really great, it'll be great for Michigan, because they are red varieties that we can grow very, very well.
Lee, what grapes do you grow at Black Star Farms? What wines do you create?
Well, Mark, we have an extensive list, and what I'd suggest for people that have an interest is we've got a great website, blackstarfarms.com, where we have a full listing. But in terms of red fruit, we grow Pinot Noir and Cabernet Franc primarily. In terms of the vinifera varieties, with a little bit of Merlot in there as well. But then, along the lines of what Carol was just suggesting, we grow a number of these hybrid varieties, what we refer to as noble hybrid varieties, like Regant and Dornfelder, which add to these or can supplement these in cooler years. What we're really seeing, I think, and along the lines of what Carol was saying, is that the southern part of the state is becoming a little bit more known and is doing a better job producing these slightly more robust red wines. We're becoming well known up here for producing really bright, very aromatic white wines, and then some lighter to medium-bodied style reds that can also be very good in their own right, but just aren't quite the substantive type of red that some people prefer. But it's, you know, it's experimentation as well. Michigan State has helped show us some new varieties that may work well for us. Some things coming in from other northern European climates like northern Italy and in northern France, and even some Germanic varieties. We're just starting to experiment with those a little bit. So we're getting a number of new things in all the time that we think will supplement and help allow us to make, you know, better and better wines over time. Really, you know, where we are in Michigan, it's still just an infantile industry. You know, we've only been here for 40 to 50 years. And when you think about some of the great grape-growing regions of the world that have been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, we're really just getting started. So I expect nothing but great things to come.
Carol, what is happening to Michigan's reputation as a wine-growing state? Is it accelerating?
Absolutely. We get contact from people around the country, especially in relation to our competition. We have judges. We have a waiting list of judges because they're excited about what's going on in Michigan. It's an emerging region, growing region, and for wine producing. And we have had some fantastic publicity around, especially in California, and people.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's because we can grow grapes here that they can't. We can, because we're a cool climate, we can grow beautiful Rieslings, beautiful Gewurztraminers, and they can't do that so well in California.
There's
so it's
something we can do in Michigan they can't do in California? How about that?
Yes, absolutely. So they're really excited to come here to try all of these wines that are very regionally correct, regionally interesting, that are so different from what you're going to have in some of the other places in the country.
Lee, what wines are you entering in competition this year?
Well, along the lines of some of what we've already discussed, Mark, we tend to enter wines that we think show best from this particular region. So we've entered a Gewurztraminer. We've entered a couple of our Rieslings. We've entered things like Pinot Blanc and Pinot Gris, and then our Pinot Noir and our Cab Franc and one of our Merlots. We also do some fortified dessert wines, things that are made like ports. So we've entered a couple of those. A couple of sparkling wines as well, because we do some nice sparkling wines up here. I mean, there's really an awful lot of variety, you know, being produced around the state. And what we often say to people who come into our tasting rooms for the first time and have maybe not experienced the tasting room experience, we just say, you know, what do you like? What do you generally drink? Or what do you generally prefer? And most often we can find something that person's going to enjoy and perhaps show them something new. One of our tasting room managers here was sharing a story with me where he had somebody walk in that said that they really only preferred sweet wines, and they ended up buying two drier style wines because it was something that they were experiencing for the first time with us, and they found that they really preferred. So, you know, it's often a great opportunity for people to learn something new, to experience something they've not had before, and to find something that, you know, it's new and exciting.
Carol, we heard that 2012 was a devastating year for Michigan's fruit crop. Did it impact the wine industry, and to what extent?
It did not.
How so?
Well, the wine grapes ripen later than a lot of the fruits that were impacted by the frosts. Juice grapes was devastated nearly completely. About 90% of the crop was gone. Wine grapes, because they ripen later, they were not at a stage yet in their growth where there were three frosts right in a row that did a small amount of damage in very small areas with early ripening grapes. but overall, we had a fantastic season. It turned out, and Lee could actually speak to this better because he works with the growers very closely.
Yeah. How has it unfolded this year, Lee?
This year we're in a pretty good state. You know, it's been, I know it was significantly more rainy in the southern part of the state. We've had a pretty good sprinkling of rain here and there, but we haven't had anywhere near the deluge that they've had in the southern part of the state. So we've had drier conditions, pretty good sunshine. We've had a bit of a cool spell here as of late, which really isn't bothersome to the grapes and to the fruit ripening, but we'd certainly like to see a little bit more heat and a little bit more sunshine. And
Okay. And
really for us, the key to the season is September and October.
Okay.
You know, we really start picking fruit towards the latter part of September. And if we get a nice September, we can have an absolutely brilliant end of the growing season. But if it dissipates and peters out on us and we end up with kind of a cool, rainy September, then it can often mean a later and longer ripening period.
Very quickly, Carol, a website where people can learn more about tomorrow?
MichiganWines.com. Information about the competition, and then a reception Thursday evening where they can try all the best wines from that competition.
Carol and Lee talking about wine in Michigan. Thanks very much, and hope tomorrow's event goes well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Scott Westerman is a longtime telecommunications executive, entrepreneur, and broadcaster. He's currently MSU Associate Vice President for Alumni Relations and Executive Director of the MSU Alumni Association. Scott's also a contributor to Current State. He recently spoke with a Big Ten business professor about getting more with less.
J. Keith Murnion is Harold Hines Jr. Distinguished Professor of Management and Organization at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He's published over a half dozen books on negotiation, organizational psychology, economics, and the art and science of high-impact leadership. His latest book is entitled Do Nothing, How to Stop Overmanaging and Become a Great Leader. It's available in bookstores, on digital platforms, and in audiobook form via audible.com. Keith, thanks for joining us in Current State.
Hey, thanks, Scott. I appreciate being on.
Why are there so few really great leaders in the world?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of really good leaders. The difficulty about getting from good to great is that people's natural tendencies get in the way. And they get in the way for a couple different reasons. Number one, evolution has really designed us to be active people. Our ancestors wouldn't have survived if they hadn't been active, and that's been passed down to us. So we, you know, the way I like to think about it, do you know how long a male lion sleeps every day?
No.
20 hours.
I would never make it on Jeopardy. 20 hours.
20 hours. Gorillas are 13.6, and chimpanzees, I'm pretty sure it's 9.7.
So they're the original do-nothing leaders then, huh?
What is our problem here, right? We are programmed to be active, and as we move up in organizations, we don't lose that programming. I mean, the other thing is we get rewarded for doing stuff. But then when we get promoted, we really need to stop doing what we've been doing, focus more on the people who are working for us, stimulate and facilitate their performance, and we'll be more effective as leaders. But too often we get in the way.
So how do you become a do-nothing leader?
Well, I think part of it is realizing that you've got some choices. And the choices start with knowing people on your team, knowing what they can do, trusting them, not being afraid to trust them, and actually realizing how wonderful the consequences are. One of the ways to do this is really scary for some leaders. It shouldn't be so scary, but take a two-week vacation. Do not bring your laptop or your cell phone. Leave things to your team for 2 weeks. See what you get when you come back. Now, most teams are not going to completely sabotage the entire organization. Instead, what you'll find is people step up, they make great decisions, they cope with problems better than you thought they ever could, and that you aren't as critical as you thought you were.
So you really start learning about the capabilities of an individual when you let them have the wide side of the field.
You got it. And too often leaders are too nervous, too fearful, not trusting enough, and they can't get themselves to do this.
Describe the vibe at a company that embraces the do-nothing leadership culture.
Well, when leaders are doing nothing, they're really not doing literally nothing. They're facilitating other people's performance. They're acting like mini CEOs. And the main rule for a CEO is three simple words: walk the floor. Get out there, talk to people, ask them how they're doing. You want to touch base with people personally, but then ask them, what can I do to help you perform better? As I've often pointed out, people are not going to ask you for a nuclear power plant. They're going to ask you for something that actually will allow them to perform better, that may not cost too much. And son of a gun, if you can supply it, if you can facilitate their performance, you're better off, the company's better off, and the people you work with can show off their skills even more.
How important is it to know what's going on outside of work to understand what's going on in their heads inside of work?
Well, you need to know people. You don't want, say in an economic downturn, which we've all experienced recently, you don't want to assign the job of coming up with a new creative strategic plan to somebody who's going through an ugly divorce, because they're going to be so distracted by their divorce, they're not going to be able to think as creatively as they might otherwise. So you do have to know people so that you can assign people jobs appropriately, depending upon what's happening in their lives. But also, they need to know you care about them. One of my old students put it very well. He said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care about them.
That was a great line in the book. I underlined that one in my Kindle edition.
I'm glad you liked it. It wasn't even mine.
Well, Zig Ziglar says, you get everything you want when you help other people get everything they want.
Well, part of my approach in the do-nothing leadership notion is to realize that leadership is a social activity. You can't do everything as a leader. You shouldn't do everything. You shouldn't do as much as you want to do. Let other people do it. It'll allow them to flourish. They want to show off their skills, and as a leader, you want to let them show off their skills.
You know, we live in an age where many leaders believe that it's all about shareholder value. And how can a leader effectively focus on the team concept you're talking about when the downward pressure is all about pleasing Wall Street?
Well, I'm not a big fan of quarterly reports, to say the least. I always hark back to a quote from Warren Buffett, who said, the companies I buy are built like family businesses. They're not all family businesses, but they're built like family business in this regard. They're looking for the long term, not for the 3-month report that Wall Street is after over and over again. I think you have to build infrastructure. You have to build people. You have to facilitate their performance. You have to help them improve. If you do things right, good things are going to happen. If you start doing the quick fix, it's going to catch up to you.
So that's what you're talking about when you're saying there's a difference between maximizing profits and maximizing value?
Part of it's that. Maximizing value, which I also wildly espouse, pays attention to the other person. So as a leader, you're going to have, I like to think of you being in teams with your supervisors, with your customers, with your suppliers, and with your own team members. And think about how they're going to react if in all of those team interactions, you're interested in maximizing value. You want what's good for your superior as well as what's good for yourself. You want what's good for your customer as well as what's good for yourself. And when people see that, they're going to be wildly attracted to you because you're not in it just for your own outcome, for your own profit. You're in it together, and you can be more creative in coming up with ideas that expand the pie so that everybody can be better off.
We're visiting with Keith Murnion, who is the author of a fascinating new leadership book, Do Nothing, How to Stop Overmanaging and Become a Great Leader. Keith, when you were in fifth grade in Sister Marie's class and she was giving you all that math homework,
exactly.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, you know, I really didn't know what I wanted to be. I can tell you that in my neighborhood, kids wanted to be policemen or firemen, and I wanted to be a little different. So I thought maybe I could be a doorman, or maybe I could be a mailman. Or, and then later in eighth grade, you know, you're graduating and they want to know what you want to be. Well, then I had higher aspirations. I thought maybe I'll be a nuclear physicist. The only reason I wanted to be a nuclear physicist was because my nickname at that time was Mr. Arithmetic, because I could add and subtract well in my head, and we didn't have calculators yet. You know, this was not a good nickname, but I'm happy that I have gotten beyond it.
And how did you finally zero in on your passion?
Well, I was really lucky to live in an apartment building. Right in an apartment right below an associate professor in the psychology department at Purdue University. And I made the rash move of asking if he was doing any research and needed help. And boy, was that fun. And then he actually arranged for me to be able to teach a full class on introductory psychology my senior year. I think they were short of TAs, and so they were desperate, and they hired me to do it. I was horrible. I was the worst teacher you could imagine, and I loved every second of it.
Sounds like he was teaching you by deviously releasing control.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I had a lot of control. I thought I was great. I really wasn't, but, man, I was having a great time. And I just loved trying to figure out why people behave the way they do and how you can create social situations for everybody's benefit.
You know, and I was mentioning that the phrase deviously releasing control. You talk about that in the book. What does that mean?
Well, leaders often take too much control naturally, and it's because they're responsible for team outcomes. But that leads them to be pretty overbearing. What I suggest instead is think about ways that you can structure situations to still retain control even when you're not around. So incentives are a perfect way to structure behavior. I mean, one of my favorite examples is, you know, tell everyone on your team that you'll pay each of them $10 if when they park their car in the company parking lot, they park it facing north. What are you going to get that next month? Everybody will be facing north because people pay attention to incentives. That's a simple example.
The book is Do Nothing, How to Stop Overmanaging and Become a Great Leader, filled with wisdom that translates well to whatever role you're now playing, and a treasure trove of advice to help you move in the direction of the person you hope to become. Keith Murnion, thanks for joining us in Current State.
Take care.
For Current State, I'm Scott Westerman.
Tomorrow on Current State, learn about how federal sequestration is impacting Capital Area Michigan Works, the Workforce Development Agency. We'll talk with Director Doug Stites. Also a discussion with rapper Coolio coming to Lansing. That and more Tuesday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. The producer of Current State is Joe Lindstraw. Thanks as well to Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.